Hi, I'm Nancy Clark, a registered dietitian who specializes in sports nutrition, nutrition for exercise and performance. I'm pleased to be with you to share some of the knowledge that I have as a registered dietitian when I work with athletes. I have a private practice in the Boston area where I meet a lot with people one-on-one, and they might be ordinary mortals, just fitness exercisers who want to lose a little bit of weight, or they might be Olympic hopefuls or professional athletes. But everybody wants to know how to build a better sports diet, how to have more energy, how to lose weight and have energy to exercise. And they have so many questions. So the purpose of this webinar is to help you to help your athletes to build a better sports diet and to resolve some of the confusion. There is just so much confusion about what to eat. So let's get going. So the goals of this session are to address the nutrition concerns and confusion of both fitness exercisers and athletes alike. We'll be talking about carbohydrates and low-carb sports diets, protein needs, protein supplements, dietary fat, including coconut oil, sports drinks, electrolytes, caffeine, energy drinks, vitamins, food versus supplements, and how to build a better sports diet. Let's just start with addressing why is sports nutrition so confusing? Certainly, advertising leads people to believe that commercial products are far better than food. I mean, you just look at this, these pictures here, and here you have all these fancy canisters, and then you have two rugby players holding up bananas. Now, which do you think is more impressive? Supplement sales are booming. You can see here the sales growth in sales from 2016 and projected up through 2027. And this certainly makes people believe that they are a very important part of a sports diet. There's a lot of trendy lingo that adds confusion. You hear people talk about good foods or bad foods. And that is way too judgmental. Eating really should not be a source of guilt or shame. Clean foods. Yeah. Is food that comes in wrappers actually dirty? What does clean mean? No sugar. No fruit. No milk or plain yogurt. No high fructose corn syrup. No refined white sugar. What are you really talking about when you say no sugar? Simple ingredients. People like labels with simple ingredients. Well, salt, sugar, white flour are simple ingredients. Social media certainly adds a lot of clickbait and sports nutrition misinformation. I mean, you just look at the different hashtags, beef builds muscles. Well, vegan athletes win. Carbs are bad. Carbo-loaded pasta. Intermittent fasting, yes. Oh no, keto works best. Exercise on empty versus fuel up for sports. There is way too much information. And the athletes are left wondering, who do I believe? So how can you resolve the confusion and help your clients to eat better? First of all, you want to make sure that you listen not only to what your clients are saying, but how they are saying it. There's a big difference between, ooh, I had a bagel for breakfast versus, oh, I had a bagel for breakfast. Encourage them to experiment with different fueling patterns. They don't have to commit to anything, but just be curious, experiment. I wonder what would happen if you had a banana before you worked out. Problem solve with them so that they have ways to overcome barriers that hinder consuming a good sports diet. No time. Well, it's interesting. People always have time to exercise, but sometimes they never have time to eat. That's interesting. Help them create a food plan that they're willing to eat for the rest of their lives. So my clients come to me wanting me to create a food plan. And it's like, no, I sort of reverse them. I give them a template and have them create their food plan because they know what foods they like and what fits their lifestyle. Dietary improvements happen when the benefits are bigger than the costs. And we know that the benefits are eating a healthier diet. You have more energy all day. You perform better, perhaps achieve your personal best. Weight management becomes easier when you eat well. But there are also costs to eating well. And the costs might be that planning food takes time and energy, and that you have fewer pig outs on yummy food. So that, you know, often I find that my clients are hesitant to eat well because maybe they won't have their chocolate chip cookies anymore. And so it's important to know that you want to look at the benefits of eating well, but also what the costs are. And when the benefits are bigger than the costs, that's when people make changes. Big source of confusion has to do with carbohydrates. We all have heard this. Carbs are evil. And I'm sure you've heard your clients say these statements, as have I. Oh, I stay away from bread. It has too many carbs. I'm on the paleo diet. I don't eat wheat or other grain foods. I don't eat pasta dinners anymore. I have a big salad instead. Oh, no orange juice. Too much sugar. Sound familiar? Well, if carbs are so evil, why then do the Kenyan athletes perform so well? The typical Kenyan diet is 77% carbohydrate, which gives them about 4.5 grams carbohydrate per pound of body weight. It's 10% protein and a very low fat, 13% fat. They live primarily on bread, rice, potato, porridge, ugali, which is a cornmeal mush, very high in carbohydrates. They eat beef, you know, small portions, maybe 4 times a week, get some protein from kidney beans. They drink a lot of tea with whole milk and lots of sugar. 20% of their total calories come from sugar. And somehow, if all these carbs are evil, they might not be doing so well. So certainly they're doing something right at the dinner table. The carbs are evil message is actually targeted toward unfit people, not at athletes. We know that 2/3 of Americans are overfat, underfit, and at high risk for heart disease, diabetes, cancer. And the body of an unfit person does not metabolize carbohydrate as well as the body of a fit person. So physical inactivity is prevalent, and that's why the messages that are given about carbs are evil is really targeted toward the masses, but it's not targeted toward athletes. We know that carbohydrates are important fuel for athletic people. This study shows how exercise helps to maintain a good normal blood glucose level. So this was a 12-week study with unfit, obese subjects, and they had them train. And over the course of 12 weeks, you could see how they needed less insulin in order to moderate their blood sugar levels, their blood glucose levels. And this is over the course of 12 weeks. Well, over the course of longer than that, the athletic body needs far less insulin to maintain normal blood glucose levels. And the muscles are just like little Pac-Man, just where's the carbs to refuel? So that the conversation about carbohydrates really needs to be a different conversation for fit people. We really need to stop demonizing a single nutrient, such as carbs. You know, when you look at a high-carb diet, it's actually associated with longevity in the blue zones. If you're not familiar with the blue zones, those are different areas around the globe where people live for a very long time, longer than most people, and they're very healthy. And their diet is a high-carb diet, but the kinds of carbs we're talking about is unprocessed foods, fruits, veggies, high-fiber diet, and lots of plant protein. So yes, that is a high-carb diet, and those carbs are not evil. Now, the high protein diet, which people rave about in America, is actually associated with a higher risk of heart disease, cancer, and all-cause mortality, how people die. And this data is from the Nurses' Health Study and the All Professionals Follow-Up Study, which involved thousands of people. So the real question is, do we really need to look more at total lifestyle than at a single nutrient like carbs, protein, sugar, salt? And when it comes to health, you know, are ultra-processed foods the real problem? We know that in the blue zones, they didn't eat a lot of ultra-processed foods, and they lived a very long and healthy life. So when my clients start complaining about carbs and carbs are evil, I stop and I ask them, what kind of carbs are you actually talking about? Are you concerned about refined white flour in bread or pasta? High fructose corn syrup in soft drinks? Sugary candy? The natural sugars in fruits and juices? I had one client who said, Nancy, no more carbs. I've given up carbs. And I said, well, what are you eating? And he said, well, I have oatmeal for breakfast, a sandwich made with whole wheat bread for lunch, and I have brown rice for dinner, but I don't eat any more carbs. So clearly he was talking more about sugary sorts of carbohydrates, but it is important to know what the clients are actually talking about. So when I work with my clients, I teach them about carbohydrates 101. Glucose, sugar, is just a single molecule, your blood sugar, your blood glucose, and it feeds your brain, fuels your muscles. Starch, or glycogen in your muscles, is just a chain of sugars that are hooked together. So the way that I explain this to my clients is like corn on the cob. When it's young, it's sweet, it's sugary. And as it gets older, the sugar converts into starch. Bananas are the opposite. When bananas aren't ripe, they're starchy. And as they get older, they get sugary. The starch converts into sugar. So sugars and starches are the same thing. And they are both carbohydrates, and they fuel your muscles. So carbohydrate is a source of fuel. It's the gas in the car. And these charts, the gray bar shows calories, carbohydrate, and all the calories in soft drink come from carbohydrate, come from sugar, but there's no vitamins or minerals with them. Whereas in orange juice, all of the calories, the gray bar, come from carbohydrate, from sugar. But along with that, you get all the vitamin C that you need for the day. Chocolate milk has sugar in it, but it also has protein in the red bar, riboflavin, the blue bar, which converts food to energy. Calcium is the green bar. And, that's very important for bones. It also helps to keep blood pressure down. But people say, oh, chocolate milk, it's got sugar in it. Yeah, but it also has protein and riboflavin and calcium and a whole package of nutrients that is life-sustaining. White bread, whole wheat bread, you can see that neither of those are powerhouse foods. Now, granted, these charts only show 65 calories of one little slice of white or whole wheat bread, but yet no grains are powerhouses compared to fruits, vegetables, protein-rich foods, and dairy foods. So that white bread, whole wheat bread, yes, there's a lot of nutrients that aren't shown off the chart, but yet if you want your powerhouse carbohydrates, look at fruits, vegetables. Now, carbohydrates are important for active people because they fuel up muscles and they refuel depleted muscles of glycogen. So what this study shows is that when you exercise hard, you deplete the glycogen that's in your muscles. And then when you go to refuel, if you have carbohydrates, if you have banana, if you have pasta, rice, grains, fruits, vegetables, those are the foods that refuel your muscles. But I find that a lot of my clients these days, they do hard exercise, and then they come back and they have a protein shake or protein bar, or maybe they have a cheese omelet, which is protein and fat. And those foods fill the stomach, but they don't refuel the muscles. So that you always want to think carb protein combinations, carbs to refuel. And yes, protein you need to build and repair. But you actually want three times more carbohydrate than protein. Now, what this chart shows is that within the hour after you exercise, your muscles are most receptive to refueling. And that if you've really depleted yourself, it can take up to 2 days to fully recover. And so this is why after, like if you're taking your rest day, on a rest day, you'll be just as hungry because your muscles are busy refueling. So carbs are indeed performance enhancing. And the amount of carbohydrate that you need really depends on how much exercise that you're doing. If you're just walking, doing light activity, you need less than if you are doing extreme 4 to 5 hours a day. So the grams of carbohydrate per pound of body weight can vary from 1.5 grams carb to 5.5 grams carbohydrate, depending on your activity level. But this is far more than I find most of my clients eating these days. So a 150-pound athlete might need 340 to 825 grams of carbohydrate a day, which is 1,350 to 3,300 calories from carbohydrate. And most of my clients are trying to stay away from those evil carbs. This is what I see among my clientele. So this is a sample low-carb training diet. You know, spinach cheese omelet for breakfast along with some turkey bacon, but no toast or bagel. You know, almonds for a snack. Salad with grilled chicken on it and lots of oil in the salad dressing in order to make it satiating, fill you up. Snacking on another protein bar. Dinner, big chunk of salmon and a pile of broccoli. And so in this scenario, only 60 grams of carbohydrate are being consumed. Like, how is this person going to be able to train at their best? And you can only compete at your best if you train at your best. And you can only train at your best on a daily basis. You're either fueling up or you're refueling. And it's the grains, fruits, and vegetables that are really important for refueling. We know that lack of carbohydrates hurts ice hockey performance. So during a hockey game, muscle glycogen declines about 38 to 88%. A motion analysis of elite ice hockey teams showed that the players with a high carb diet skated 30% more distance and faster than the players who ate the standard American diet, 40% carbohydrate. And in the final period, which your games are won or lost in the final period, the difference in performance were clear. The high carb group skated 11% more distance. The low carb group skated 14% less distance than in the first period. So maybe this is hockey, soccer, basketball, all of these team sports, stop and stop sports. Muscle glycogen is really important for optimal performance. This study shows how fueling with carbohydrates before and during exercise really improves endurance performance. So in this study, there was one trial where the subjects had nothing to eat before they exercised, and they had just water during training. So they did this test, they had dinner the night before, and then nothing to eat before this morning exercise test. And they ran for as long as they could, 102 minutes. In the second trial, they had a meal 3 hours before they exercised, and then they had water during the exercise, and they were able to run for 112 minutes. So that's 10 minutes more when they had a meal 3 hours beforehand. But look at this, when they had the meal 3 hours beforehand and carbohydrates during, i.e. a sports drink, they were able to run for 125 minutes. So that's 23 minutes more just with proper fueling. And it's amazing to me, the number of my clients, you know, I live in Boston, all these Boston people that are training for the Boston Marathon, that they train on empty and they can't nearly run nearly as well as they could if they were to train better. Fuel up, fuel during, and then again to refuel afterwards. Adequate carbs improve marathon time. Now, this is an interesting study where they had just ordinary mortals, non-elite runners, and they asked them what they thought their predicted marathon time would be. And then they were paired into two groups. So they had these two groups of runners and with matching predicted marathon times in each group. With one group, they didn't give them any nutrition education. And they actually completed the marathon in 3 hours and 49 minutes. In the second group, they gave them nutrition information, scientifically based, a sports nutrition plan. And they ran for 3 hours and 38 minutes, which was about 11 minutes faster than the other group. And they were older. So if anything, they should have run slower. But what they found is that if you give runners a plan and you teach them how to fuel their body properly, that they can perform better. And their planned feeding was to have two gels plus water 10 to 15 minutes before the marathon started. And then at 40 minutes, take another gel, then a gel every 20 minutes after that, plus 24 ounces of water per hour. Now, I've had runners that, you know, they go to the 18-mile mark, and when they start to bonk, they pull out a gel. It's like, no, you want to prevent that from happening. You want to come up with a plan that you practice during training, and so that you know what settles well, what foods work for you, and there are no surprises. And you will get feel the benefit performing better. Now, with this study, which used gels, and a lot of people go, oh, gels, they really upset my intestinal tract. There were really similar complaints in each group, and there were no differences. So this is where people need to practice during training to figure out if gels work for them, what foods work best, but in order to hit their calorie targets, their carbohydrate targets. And generally 30 to 60 grams of carbohydrate per hour during endurance exercise is a wise choice. 60 grams carb per hour, that's 240 calories. Now, how do athletes who limit their carbs fuel their muscles? And the answer is, oh, I eat lots of fruits and vegetables for my carbohydrates. Well, if you take out the bagel and replace it with 16 strawberries, a cup of blueberries, a medium banana, then you will replace those carbohydrates. And you could do that with a smoothie. You know, that probably wouldn't be too difficult. It might be expensive, but it could be done. One big smoothie. Now, if you stop having a sandwich with pretzels, you replace it with a big salad. Well, in that salad, you need 24 cherry tomatoes, 2 cucumbers, 2 carrots, 2 large peppers, and 5 cups of greens. Talk about a huge salad. Talk about a lot of time to eat it, a lot of money to pay for all of that, and also a lot of fiber. No pasta at dinner. In order to replace the carbohydrates in that 2 cups of pasta, you'd need to eat 2 cups of cooked kale. That's a lot of kale. 8 spears of broccoli, 3 cups of cooked zucchini sauteed with a large onion. Now, you could do this, but do you? And it sounds a little bit unrealistic to me, and also would end up with a whole bunch of fiber and a lot of intestinal problems and probably undesired pit stops along the way. So grains certainly can be helpful for athletes who train hard. Now, if you are training hard and eating a low-carb diet, it leads to needless fatigue. In this study, the subjects were told to run 10 miles hard 3 days in a row. And they were college students eating typical school food. You know, too many burgers, too many fries, too much pepperoni pizza with double cheese, too much beer, not enough carbohydrate, not enough grains, fruits, vegetables. And their glycogen stores went down. That was 3 days. What happens in 3 weeks? 3 months. And a lot of athletes are training hard day after day after day. So it's no wonder that clients come into my office and say, I feel so tired. Like I just have dead legs. You know, something must be wrong with my diet. And they think they're eating really well because they're having lots of fruits and vegetables. But it's just like I say, it's really hard to get enough carbohydrates if you're just not having any potato, rice, noodles, pasta with dinner. This is a visual of the depletion of muscle glycogen stores over a football team season, August through November. And muscle sound is a way to measure the amount of glycogen that's in your muscles. And you can see how the players, their glycogen stores went down just over the course of the season. And that's exactly what you don't want to happen. You know, at the end of the season, you want to be fresh as a daisy. So when you enter the championships, that you'll be better than everybody else. So this is where nutrition works. It makes a really big difference. And it's really important to educate both fitness exercisers and athletes alike about the power of carbohydrates. But I feel so much better when I don't eat grains. And then you've likely heard that as well. And whenever anyone talks about, oh, I feel so much better when I don't eat grains, I ask them, what were you eating before you made this big dietary change? And the chances are they were eating the SAD diet, the standard American diet. And so often when people make major food changes, they shape up their diet. They start eating more fruits, vegetables, unprocessed foods. And these all are welcomed by the microbiome. We have all these bacteria that live in our gut, and they impact how we feel. They impact our mood, our health, our immune system. So when people switch from eating a lousy diet to eating better, of course they feel better. And when if they go from hit or miss meals of, you know, living out of vending machines, of course they feel better when they eat home-cooked food, as generally happens when people go on a paleo-type diet. They aren't just living hit or miss, they have a plan now. That said, each person is an experiment of one. So I always, again, listen to my clients, listen to the changes that they've made, why they feel so much better, and try to piece together the information and giving helping them to understand that it might not be lack of grains that's the problem, but the addition of lots of fruits and vegetables. You know, what about gluten-free athletes? There are some athletes that can't eat wheat if they have celiac disease or if they're gluten intolerant. Can they consume adequate muscle fuel? Of course they can. There are a lot of gluten-free foods that we commonly eat. You know, rice, potato, corn, starchy vegetables, you know, beans, lentils, you know, oats and oats need to be labeled gluten-free because many times oatmeal is processed in a plant that processes other wheat products. So if someone really is severely needs to be 100% gluten-free, then they need to look for gluten-free oats. But for the most part, oatmeal is a very low gluten food. Fruits, vegetables are naturally gluten-free. There are sports foods, Lara bars, Kind bars, Clif bars, that are all gluten-free. And so working with my athletes that want to be gluten-free or need to be gluten-free, you know, I give them all sorts of ideas of what they can eat. And they go, oh, maybe this isn't so bad after all. There is life beyond pasta for carbo loading. Question arises, what's the right balance of protein and carbohydrate? I find that my clients these days are really into protein, and they think that protein is the foundation of the sports diet. Whereas in actuality, it's really carbohydrates that should be the foundation of the sports diet. I just can't emphasize enough that protein or protein and fat do not replenish depleted glycogen stores. So as I mentioned before, you do hard exercise, you deplete your muscles of glycogen. If you come back and have cheese omelets, you know, a chicken Caesar salad, a big serving of fish with just some green beans on the side. It's basically a high protein diet. That those foods will fill your stomach, but they will not refuel your muscles. So this is where you actually need 3 times more carbohydrate than protein. And most people are eating, many athletes these days are eating, trying to eat 3 times more protein than carbohydrates. They've just got it backwards. The problem with high protein diets is if you eat too much protein, you displace the carbs. If you're having eggs for breakfast, you aren't having oatmeal. If you're having a salad with grilled chicken on it for lunch, you aren't having the bread in the sandwich. So it displaces carbohydrates. You know, depending on the kind of protein you're eating, it can be high in saturated fat and cholesterol. I see a lot of bacon and sausage these days. It, you know, can impact the environment. A lot of people these days are concerned about sustainability. And it's expensive, you know, it can be a waste of money because your body doesn't use extra protein to build muscle. It's not a high protein diet that builds muscle. It's exercise that builds muscle. And in order to have the energy to do the muscle building exercise, you need to have grains, fruits, vegetables, carbohydrate rich foods, because it's the carbs that give you the energy to do the heavy lifting. Now, if you're the parent of a high school kid and they think they need a lot of chicken, a lot of protein, you know, you'll go through your food budget a lot faster than if you convince them that actually they need extra carbohydrates, extra pasta. So for athletes where budget is a concern, they need to know that they do not need to eat excessive amounts of protein. So when I work with my clients, I estimate their protein needs, and it's based on body weight. It's not percentage of calories, but protein needs are based on your body weight. So the current RDA, 0.8 grams protein per kilogram, is based on sedentary, inactive people. For an athletic adult, generally I use 1 to 1.5 grams protein per kilogram, or 0.5 to 0.75 grams protein per pound of body weight. Growing teenagers need a bit more. If someone, a sedentary person, starts building muscle as an adult, start shaping up, then they would have a higher protein need. People who are restricting calories, if they're on a diet, dieting definitely increases protein needs, because a lot of the protein that gets eaten is gets used for gas, for fuel, and not for building and repairing muscles. A 120-pound athlete might need 65 to 110 grams of protein a day. 150-pound athlete might require 80 to 115 grams of protein a day. And those are very easy to consume just through standard meals. So here's what I see my clients eating. If they're into having a high protein diet, they might have a big 6 egg whites for breakfast, snack on cottage cheese, have a chunk of deli turkey for lunch, you know, Greek yogurt for snack, slab of salmon for dinner, 160 grams of protein, and they don't even need that much. And that's only within 900 calories. And if they're doing a lot of exercise, they probably need 2,000, 3,000 calories. So again, most of the research shows that athletes can consume the protein that can and do consume the protein that they need as long as they are eating. The people who might not get enough protein are those that are dieting. For example, people with eating disorders who are not eating very much at all and are not eating very much protein at all. So that is a separate conversation. But for the average healthy person with a hearty appetite, you know, they're getting the protein that they need. So that they come to me saying, how many protein bars and protein shakes do I need? It's like, no, you need more carb bars and carb shakes. Fruit smoothies, please. Vegetarian and vegan athletes are certainly concerned about their protein needs, wondering, can they get the protein they need from just plant foods? Of course they can. There are many vegan and vegetarian athletes that are pros, Olympians. So the problem isn't being vegetarian or vegan. The problem is being responsible. So when I work with my vegetarians or vegans, I look to make sure they're getting enough protein. for chickpeas, you need a half a cup of them to get 6 grams. I've had vegetarians that just sprinkle a few garbanzos on a salad and think that's their protein pellets for the day. You know, hummus, they use just a dip a carrot into a little bit. No, if you have 3 tablespoons of hummus, you might get 3 grams of protein. So again, it's the dose. You need to make sure that you're eating enough beans, legumes, nuts, seeds. It's fine with me for athletes to be vegetarian or vegan. They just need to be responsible. And it's hard to do if they're hit or miss meals. And so that it's a matter of being responsible, planning their meals, having the right foods available at the right time. The concern that I do address is that plant foods have less leucine. Leucine is an amino acid that triggers muscle synthesis. So in order for the muscle, the protein in the muscle to grow. So if you have, say, instead of 2 eggs for breakfast with 1.1 gram leucine, you trade in your eggs and toast for peanut butter and toast, you've cut your leucine intake in half. If you trade in dairy milk for soy milk, again, half the amount of leucine. Trade the tuna fish for black beans in your salad, and you got a third of the amount of protein, of leucine. Trade the chicken breast for tofu, again, a lot less leucine. You know, instead of snacking on cheese, you snack on almonds, half the leucine. Trade in your beef for lentil soup, a lot less leucine. So the goal is to have 2.5 grams of leucine every meal, every 3 to 4 hours, if you really want to optimize your muscle growth. And this can be done, again, it's just called being responsible. And for people that are eating plant-based and wanting to have plant-based proteins, to know that they need to eat, you know, hearty portions of them and not just a skimming of peanut butter, but, you know, a good spreading of peanut butter on their toast. Here's a sample diet, again, showing how you can get the protein that you needed if you're a vegetarian. And if you're having overnight oats and soak it in milk, either dairy milk or soy milk would have 8 grams of protein. Put in some walnuts, and you get 15 to 25 grams of protein that you should be your target every 3 to 4 hours. So I look at protein pacing. It's important to have protein spread evenly throughout the day, not just for vegans or vegetarians, but for everybody. And if you just have bagel for breakfast, salad for lunch, and then, you know, chicken for dinner, or a big, you know, chunk of tofu for dinner, depending on what your protein source is, then there's been a whole desert from the time you go to bed until, you know, dinner the next day. So we want to make sure that the protein is spaced evenly throughout the day, 15 to 20 grams of protein every 3 to 4 hours. So you have your breakfast protein that lasts you to lunch. Lunch, you have a wrap and a yogurt that gives you a good dose of protein. 4 o'clock, you have apple and peanut butter. Dinner at 7, eat the whole can of soup, some bread, then snack before you go to bed. And so you can see how getting the protein needed is not difficult. And this is within 2,300 calories, which is what a female might eat and probably doesn't need the 105 grams of protein. Now, if you are vegan or vegetarian, you know, and eating a lot more beans, you might start worrying about intestinal issues. I got an email from a client who said, Nancy, I started eating a lot more beans in my effort to be more plant-based, and it's like causing problems on my runs, undesired pit stops. So what we're talking about is FODMAPs, fermentable oligodimonosaccharides and polyols. And these are kinds of carbohydrates, kinds of fiber that get digested in the intestines. Fermentable means gas producing. So they can create gas, bloat. Sometimes they cause constipation in some people, other people they cause diarrhea, but certainly they contribute to intestinal distress. So some common FODMAP trigger foods could be wheat, gluten, could be lentils or beans. Inulin is a fiber, it's like a fake, not a fake fiber, but it's a kind of fiber that's often added to high fiber crackers or bars. Sorbitol is a sugar alcohol that's in sugar-free gum. You know, who would guess that onions, garlic would cause problems? Apples, avocados. So when people come to me concerned with intestinal issues and gas, bloating, constipation, diarrhea, we talk about FODMAPs, and I inevitably end up referring them to katescarlotta.com. And Kate is a dietitian who really specializes in FODMAP diets and helping people to resolve their intestinal issues. Now, there's research that shows for athletes that are concerned about undesired pit stops during an event, that if they stay away from high FODMAP foods for 2 or 3 days before the event, that really reduces the incidence of undesired pit stops. And so that is something that can be easily managed through the diet. What about amino acids? You know, we've talked about carbs, talking about protein. And as we know, amino acids are the building blocks of protein. And so protein is made up of all these different kinds of amino acids. And people think, oh, you have to buy amino acids. It's like, no, you know, you just have to eat them. You get them in chicken. So if you want to get essential amino acids, you can buy whey protein. You can also just drink milk or chocolate milk, have a can of tuna fish, eat some cottage cheese. You know, it's very easy to get the leucine that you're needing through your diet, and particularly easier if you're eating animal proteins. And we know, like I said before, that leucine is what triggers muscle protein synthesis. You know, chicken. When it comes to comparing amino acids pills versus the protein in real food, it's important to keep in mind that protein-rich foods, they come in a supportive food matrix that contains a variety of nutrients and bioactive compounds that work synergistically, so that food really works in a way that is different than if you have an isolated amino acid, you know, like your branched-chain amino acid, like leucine or isoleucine, valine. And if you have an isolated amino acid, it facilitates a weaker muscle building effect than whole foods do. So I'm always advocating for eating protein from food and not from supplements. It's safer. There's no question as to what's in it. And it's more effective. For example, a study showed that whole milk stimulated greater amino acid uptake than skim milk. I mean, just having the fat in the milk made a difference. Another study showed that a whole egg, as compared to just the egg white, triggered a 30% higher rate of post-exercise muscle protein synthesis. And these are just two little examples of how powerful whole food is. So in general, you know, you want to have the less processed foods and fewer supplements and more natural. I have a case study here to sort of pull together this protein session of a high school student who wants to bulk up. He comes to me and he says, I play lacrosse and ice hockey. I want to bulk up. I want to be stronger, more powerful. I want to be able to fight back against those other players. 17 years old, he was a junior in high school. He was 5'8" tall, weighed 144, so he was on the leaner side. His goal was gain 20 pounds of muscle. I always ask my clients, how do your parents look? And he said that his parents were thin when they were his age. Now they've gained weight with age just due to lifestyle, but basically his parents are lean. He takes medications for ADD, attention deficit disorder. And as you know, ADD meds tend to kill the appetite. And so he'd take that in the morning and he wouldn't have much of an appetite during the day. He I had a low intake of fruits and vegetables. I asked him, as I do my clients, what does a typical day look like in terms of food and exercise? And generally he would sleep until seven in the morning. And of course, then he'd have no time for breakfast. He really didn't have much of an appetite at all for lunch due to his meds. And maybe he'd eat a protein bar, but maybe he wouldn't. He played sports after school. So here he's been, you know, functioning on empty all day. When he got home, he was ravenous and he would have a huge dinner. And then he would snack, snack, snack all night. And the problem was his snacks weren't the food that he missed at breakfast and lunch. His snacks were chips, ice cream, cookies, etc. So certainly nutritionally that took a toll. So when I worked with him, I estimated his calorie needs and I figured that he needed at least 3,600 calories a day. And I wanted that to be evenly spread out across the day because we know that what you eat at breakfast and lunch helps fuel the afternoon workout. And there are studies that show when athletes don't eat breakfast and just have a pre-exercise snack later in the afternoon, that they still don't perform as well as if they've had breakfast earlier in the day. So I estimated his energy needs and gave him the targets of 800 calories for breakfast, 800 for lunch. Dinner would sort of fall into place. It could easily be 1,000, 1,400 calories, like a half a pizza. After dinner, 400, 600 calories. Then I call that after dinner, instead of a snack, his second dinner. Lots of times languaging just makes a difference. And explain to him what he was eating after dinner was really his breakfast for the next morning. or what he would miss if he was eating all sorts of, you know, snacky foods. So we put the focus on daytime food intake. You know, as I mentioned, athletes are either fueling up or they are refueling. And what he was eating at breakfast and lunch would fuel his afternoon workout so he would be able to perform better. Maybe he didn't need to gain 20 pounds of muscle to be a better athlete. Maybe he just needed to fuel better. So we identified, you know, different ideas of things that he might have for breakfast for 800 calories. Maybe you could throw together a smoothie with yogurt, peanut butter, and banana. That could easily be 500 calories. And then take a protein bar that maybe he could break it into little pieces and snack on during the day. At lunch, take a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And maybe if you just cut it into quarters, you could just eat little bits of it. Take, you know, a chocolate milk box and a juice box and drink that. He found that fluids were really easier for him than eating solid food. So with his input, we identified, you know, the minimal amount for him to be eating at breakfast or breakfast snack, lunch or lunch snack. I didn't care as much about dinner or evening because I knew that that would take care of itself. So the teaching points were that due to his medications, he needed to eat mechanically. He may not feel hungry, but his body needed fuel. And so he just had to mechanically hit those calorie targets. If fluids were easy, I encouraged him to drink a lot of milk, a lot of juice. You know, little babies live on milk. It is life-sustaining. It is nourishing. In terms of juice, he was concerned, like, oh, isn't it filled with sugar? I said, yes, it has carbohydrate in it. That's what fuels your muscles. But if you have different colors of juice, so if you have orange juice, purple grape juice, yellow pineapple juice, red cranberry juice, you get these different juices. They're made from different fruits that they have different nutrients. And he really wasn't eating a lot of fruit. So this is one way for him to bump up his fruit intake. And it would give him nutrients that he wasn't getting. Plus it would give him the carbohydrates that he needed to fuel his muscles. The goal was to consume adequate protein, extra carbohydrate. And like most people, he thought that he needed protein, protein, protein. Actually, he needed three times more carbs than protein. We talked about how an excellent sports diet did not need to be a perfect diet. Like I said, he was concerned about sugar and juice, but then he'd go in and eat cookies. but I look for 85 to 90% quality food, 10 to 15% whatever. So this is where his after dinner snacks, I frame them as a second dinner. You know, make a sandwich, have a bowl of cereal, milk, and banana, but just to eat food and not just snacks. And we also talked about how the body that he had as a junior in high school would not be the body he had as a senior in high school, a freshman in college, a senior in college, so that his body was changing a lot. And yes, his goal was to gain 20 pounds now, but that might not happen. But it would, it potentially could happen over the course of several years. We've talked about carbs, talked about protein. Fat is also a valuable part of a sports diet. Fat is needed to absorb certain vitamins, A, D, E, and K. So if you have a salad with just spinach and no dressing on it, you aren't able to absorb the vitamins, you know, all those good nutrients in the spinach, all that vitamin A. and here's a study looking at female runners who had low fat intake. These female runners, there were two groups of them. One had irregular menses, which is a sign that they were under eating, restricting their calorie intake, which generally means they're restricting their fat intake. And they had subnormal vitamin E levels in their blood, which is kind of interesting. You take your blood test for vitamin E and you expect it to be normal, but because they had a low fat diet, they had subnormal vitamin E levels. Versus the regularly menstruating runners who were eating enough calories and eating more fat, they had normal vitamin E levels. So a large part of my clientele is athletes who are very weight conscious. Many of them have disordered eating patterns or outright eating disorders. And they come to me with irregular menstrual periods, avoiding fat like crazy, having skim milk and fat-free frozen yogurt and fat-free everything. So I need to remind them that they need fat in each meal. Too little fat actually hurts performance. So they need the fat not only to absorb certain vitamins, but because a little bit of fat gets stored in your muscles and it's important for endurance exercise. So here we have a study with some trained runners who ate either a low-fat 16% fat diet or a more standard 31% fat diet. And they did this for a month. They were taught how to select this diet so that they self-selected the foods. They were supposed to be equal in calories, but when the runners ate more fat, they actually ended up eating about 19% more calories. So you think if they're eating more fat and more calories that they would have gotten fat? Not the case. There was no change in percent body fat. So what that says to me is that they had been under eating and hibernating. And when they added more calories to the diet, whether it's in the form of fat or whatever, that they kicked in their metabolism and their body just sort of perked up. And they had 14% more endurance when they ate more fat and more fuel, more calories in general. So the conclusion was that runners can perform better when they have healthy, preferably healthy, dietary fat. You know, as long as they're eating enough carbohydrates and enough calories, and that eating, you know, the fat in their diet gave them the added calories that they need. And this sort of flies in the face of, oh no, eat fat, get fat. It's like, no. Eat fat, fuel better, and absorb vitamins. It's an important part of a sports diet. In talking about fat, inevitably questions come up like, what about coconut oil? Well, the research to date, when it looks at the scientific research, well-controlled studies, shows that coconut oil results in significantly higher LDL cholesterol, that's the bad cholesterol, than non-tropical vegetable oils such as, you know, olive oil, avocado oil. And so the American Heart Association has yet to endorse coconut oil as being an oil of choice. So the athlete's intake of fat should be in accordance with public health guidelines. And the guidelines are to limit saturated fat to less than 10% of total calories. And if they have heart disease or high cholesterol levels, less than 7% of total calories. So that there's really space for just a little bit of coconut oil in the diet if people prefer it for taste. But I'm not an advocate of like bulletproof coffee. And when it comes to fat, do we need to look more at the total dietary pattern in which saturated fats are consumed than at the saturated fat intake alone? And it's important, again, we isolate nutrients, carbs, sugar, salt, fat, saturated fat. And when you isolate a nutrient, you aren't looking at the whole meal, the whole day, the whole week, the whole month intake. And it's more important that we look at the eating pattern. And generally the patterns with lots of saturated fat are less healthful than the patterns with more of the plant-based oils. So keto diet, a very high fat diet, has been getting a lot of support these days. So what about a keto diet for athletes? To date, the peer-reviewed research does not support fat as the best fuel to enhance performance for hard exercise. You might be able to perform as well once you've adapted to a keto diet, but it does not enhance performance. Displacing carbs with protein and fat, and the keto diet is actually a high fat diet with moderate protein, can actually hurt the ability to sprint and do high intensity exercise. So if you're competitive and at the end of the race, you need to sprint to the finish, you probably won't be able to have that final kick. That said, there's research that shows that training depleted with low muscle glycogen a few times a week might enhance fat adaptation so that you get adapted to burning more fat, which spares the muscle, the limited muscle glycogen. And for highly competitive athletes or serious athletes, this is something that they might want to do. So maybe they, you know, do a hard workout the night before. If they're doing double workouts, they do a hard workout at night, then they just have some chicken and a few lettuce leaves for dinner, but no carbohydrates. Then they train empty the next morning and do another workout where they have, before their muscles have chance to refuel. And that perhaps that might create adaptations so that in a competitive environment where they are fully fueled, that they're able to burn more fat, spare the glycogen, have greater stamina and endurance. But the question comes up, you know, what kind of fat are you eating? And is a high fat diet the healthiest? There's a lot that we don't know. So when it comes to keto diets for athletes, there's just a lot of questions that need to be addressed. You know, how well controlled was the diet? When you look at the research, you know, did they provide their own food or was it the food provided for them? Was ketosis confirmed by measuring the beta hydroxybutyrate? Did they use keto sticks to measure, or did they just assume that they were in ketosis? Did the subject self-select being in the intervention group? It's like, oh, I want to be in the keto diet. I've heard really good things about it. Would that bias the results because they really believed in it? Was there a control group that did the same amount of exercise and ate the same amount of calories? What's the optimal amount of time needed to adapt to ketosis? You know, does a 3-week study give the same results as a 6-week study or a 6-month study? How much time do people need to adapt to ketosis? Do some athletes respond better than others to a keto diet? You know, just anecdotally, I would say yes. You know, I've had clients that go, wow, I feel so good on the keto diet. And other athletes say, oh, you know, I tried that for like a week and not for me. did weight loss impact the performance results, you know, for better or for worse? You know, for some athletes, if they go on keto, that they lose fat. And if they're lighter, maybe that's what makes them better and makes the keto diet seem like it's performance enhancing. Or maybe losing weight left them poorly fueled and it hurt their performance. So we need a lot more research, I think, to sort of get to the bottom of all of this. But in the meantime, the biggest question is, how long do you really want to sustain a keto diet? And is there a backlash? Generally, diets don't work. And for every diet, there's a backlash, which tends to be binging on carbohydrates and weight gain. The next topic has to do with sports drinks. And what about sports drinks? Well, they're marketed to everybody, not just to endurance athletes. Certainly, you know, the sports drink people, they want to sell it to fitness exercisers, to anybody who will buy it. And we know that many fitness exercisers misuse them. I had a client once that came in at 9 a.m. drinking some Gatorade. And I knew he didn't exercise until later in the afternoon. So I said, just out of curiosity, why are you drinking this sports drink now? And he stopped and he goes, for the electrolytes. But I don't even know what electrolytes are. And so marketing, you know, is doing its job. So many fitness exercisers misuse them. Sports drinks are designed to be taken during endurance exercise. That many fitness exercise, they drink water during exercise and they'll drink a Gatorade afterwards as a thirst quencher. And that's when actually you want a carb protein combination for recovery. So like a chocolate milk is a much better recovery drink than just a carbohydrate drink. We also know that sports drinks are associated with weight gain in teens and that, you know, they're clearly abusing them, over drinking them. Yeah, but what about sodium? What about the electrolytes? And the need for sodium, consuming extra salt, sodium is a part of salt. You know, during fitness training, it's unlikely, it's very unlikely is necessary. So not necessary during most fitness trainers. If you're doing moderate exercise, generally it's not necessary. But if you're out there exercising for a long time in the heat, doing a lot of sweating, it could be a wise choice. So we really have to look at who is concerned about electrolytes. And I've had clients who think that if they just go to the gym and do a workout, they've got to, you know, replace their electrolytes. It's like, no, you haven't sweat enough to do that. Now, the need for electrolytes in hot weather, if you're doing a lot of exercise in the heat, there could be a real need for added sodium. And so this is an interesting study where they had some trained cyclists who drank a beverage, either a low sodium beverage, 150 milligrams of sodium, or 1,000 milligrams of sodium, which is like 2 packets of salt, before they did this exercise test in the heat. Then they did this, they were told to ride to exhaustion in 90 degree heat without drinking anything. When they had the high sodium intake, they were able to ride for 20 minutes longer than when they had the lower sodium beverage. So they went for 99 instead of 79 minutes. Now, this is because the salt holds water in the body. So it takes longer for the body to become dehydrated. So if you're working with athletes who are doing a lot of exercise in the heat, then have them eat something salty beforehand. Maybe put salt in their oatmeal, salt on their eggs, or have some soup for a pre-exercise snack. And yes, they could drink sports drinks, but the amount of sodium that's in the sports drink is like, you know, 110 milligrams in the glass of Gatorade, 125 milligrams of sodium in a slice of bread. So that real food works. So when we look at sodium losses during exercise, a pound of sweat loss might contain 450, 700 milligrams of sodium. If you exercise for an hour in the heat, you might lose 900, 2800 milligrams of sodium. The body, average body, contains 97,000 milligrams of sodium. So you lose some sodium, but you are unlikely to become depleted. And when you think about it, when you sweat, you lose proportionally more water than you do sodium. So the amount of sodium in your blood actually increases during exercise. So the problem with hyponatremia, low sodium, is not because people have lost a lot in sweat, but they tend to overhydrate. So even though they've lost sodium, they dilute it down further by overhydrating. So that's why you don't want to overhydrate. You want to know how much sweat you lose by weighing yourself before and after you exercise and replacing it accordingly. Now, when we look at sources of sodium, sports drinks, you can buy these electrolytes, but they really don't have as much sodium as you might get in a cheese stick, you know, some beef jerky, just sprinkling salt on food. Like cyclists, lots of times they have boiled potatoes that they roll it in olive oil, Parmesan cheese, and salt, and then they snack on those. That's a great way to get some sodium as well as potassium. But potassium really isn't an electrolyte of concern for the most part. You know, chicken broth, high in sodium. So if the body needs salt, it tends to crave salt. There is such a thing as a salt craving. So I have people listen to their bodies. And if they're craving salt, you know, just put some extra salt on your food. And that'll do the job. Chocolate milk is a way to replace sodium. So here's a study where they had 11 dehydrated subjects, and they did this exercise test, and they measured how much sweat they lost, and then they replaced 150% of the sweat losses. So if they lost 2 pounds, they gave them 3 pounds of fluid to replace. And they ended up drinking about 2 quarts. When the beverage was milk, they got a lot more sodium, 1,000 milligrams of sodium, as compared to Powerade, which is only 440 milligrams of sodium. And you can see how their urine loss, the less sodium, the more urine loss. So the body, the salt helps to retain fluid in the body. So what this study shows is that food, milk, works, as does, you know, most types of recovery food, where you have more than just a sports drink. And they found that the milk had emptied slower. It limited the influx of fluid into the system. It was well tolerated, provided protein for recovery. And this is what we're always looking for, carb-protein combinations. So chocolate milk is carbohydrate as well as protein. What about caffeine? You know, isn't coffee bad for you? And it's like, no, coffee actually is from a plant. It's got all these plant compounds that are actually health protective. So that's the good news. Coffee abuse is bad for you. So sleep for certain is a very important part of a sports diet, of in an athlete's lifestyle. But many people think that coffee is bad. The research shows that caffeine actually enhances exercise. You know, on the plus side, caffeine can make the exercise seem easier, and it can enhance performance. And it doesn't matter if you regularly consume coffee or not, it's the same results. But on the minus side, it can cause nervousness and an upset stomach. And if you're already nervous and anxious before an event, do you really need some caffeine to put you over the edge? So even though the research shows that caffeine is an ergogenic aid, it's really an individual conversation. And each person knows their body and they need to choose their caffeine appropriately. You know, I was talking to Bill Rogers, marathon runner, and asking him if do you drink coffee before a marathon? He goes, yeah, helps me take a dump. And so, you know, And he went on to say that more marathons are won or lost in the porta toilet than they are at the dinner table. And so caffeine for most people, when it's a part of their normal routine, it does help to people to take a dump. And that's an important part of the pre-exercise planning. Caffeine is not dehydrating. For a while, people thought that it was, that you should stay away from caffeine, particularly in hot weather. But the Army has a lot of soldiers who exercise in hot weather, and they are very concerned. Should these soldiers be drinking coffee or not? And what they found is that there really wasn't a diuretic effect in caffeine-tolerant athletes, which means that the athletes that normally drink coffee, and that's who would be drinking it pre-event, in, you know, standard doses. It does not increase heat stress. And it's okay to drink caffeinated beverages in hot weather. So that was good news. And in this study, 59 coffee drinkers consumed, you know, the amount of caffeine, 1.5 milligrams of caffeine per pound, about 3 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, which is about a 12-ounce mug. And they found that they were able to perform for 86 minutes versus 75 minutes in the heat. Again, it made the effort seem easier. It enhanced their performance. And so certainly this is good news for coffee drinkers. And where there's getting to be more and more heat these days due to climate change, it'll make a lot of athletes happy. What about energy drinks? You know, I got a lot of questions from my college students. What about energy drinks? Well, the bigger question is, why do you need an energy drink? Have you had breakfast, lunch? You know, no, slept through breakfast, no time for lunch. So of course you're looking for quick energy. So the need for energy drinks is really part of a bigger conversation. Energy drinks is the symptom. And the problem is, why do you need something for quick energy? What about breakfast and lunch? In terms of caffeine, you know, if you want caffeine, yes, you could get 80 milligrams of caffeine in a can of Red Bull, but you could also go to Starbucks and get a large coffee. you know, people think that Coke and Pepsi have a lot of caffeine in it, but actually it's not as much as only 35 milligrams. What gives it the zing is the sugar in the Coke, the Pepsi, as well as the Red Bull. You know, athletes tend to want, you know, a specific dose. And so that in cliff shots or no dose, they can get really the exact amount that they need. The amount of caffeine in coffee, brewed coffee, varies a lot. Even from Starbucks to Starbucks, the amount of caffeine, the content varies. So if an athlete is really serious and knows that they perform best on, you know, 100 milligrams of caffeine an hour, then they really want to go with a pre-measured source of caffeine. The position stand on energy drinks and energy shots suggests that the primary ergogenic ingredients appear to be carbohydrate and caffeine, sugar and caffeine, and their benefits have been well established. The other ingredients require further study to demonstrate safety and potential benefits. And more than a serving a day may lead to adverse events and harmful side effects. So, you know, Red Bull might put wings on your feet, but really it's just the sugar and the caffeine and likely not the other ingredients. Be careful. Energy drinks have been blamed for death. Here's a 16-year-old who had a heart attack. She'd been drinking energy drinks instead of water all day at the beach. She started complaining she didn't feel well, and she had a heart attack and died. I had a teenage athlete who loved his Monster, and he had a couple of Monsters before his basketball practice, and he ended up in the emergency room with heart palpitations. So some might be okay, but a lot might not be. You know, the biggest concerns about energy drinks is that they're commonly used as a mixer for alcohol among college students. And, you know, a little bit of sugar helps that medicine go down. Caffeine in energy drinks keeps one from getting drowsy. So you have these wide awake drunks who are at high risk for car accidents. And this has been documented in the research. So if you mix Red Bull, which is a stimulant, and you drink alcohol, which is a depressant, you can end up with an increased risk of abnormal heart rhythms. And there's a risk of caffeine overdose in people that normally don't drink caffeine, don't drink coffee. So again, I see energy drinks as the symptom, and I really put it into the bigger conversation of why do you need an energy drink? What about vitamin and mineral pills? Well, no amount of supplements will compensate for a lousy diet. It's like, oh, I don't eat well, so I just take a vitamin pill. It's like, no, doesn't work quite that way. Food offers more than just vitamins. So here we have a chart that shows, talks about polyphenols, which are, you know, bioactive compounds that are in plants. And there are also different polyphenols that have anti-inflammatory effects. They impact the immune system. And it's very important to eat fruits, vegetables, whole grains, seeds, nuts. Those are really Mother Nature's vitamins. And so even if you take a vitamin pill, you still need to eat well anyway, because food contains more than just vitamins. But the bigger question is, do athletes need extra vitamins and minerals? And a review of 90 studies that examining vitamin and mineral status in athletes' blood, one of the studies just showed the vitamin and mineral content in their diet, but in their blood, suggests that athletes and non-athletes have similar vitamin status. And this means that if you're an Ironman triathlete, you don't have lower levels of B vitamins than a non-athlete. The exception was lower serum ferritin iron, which we know tends to be lower in athletes. That is a known fact. People that had a stronger vitamin status, like higher levels of vitamin C, didn't perform any better than athletes that had a lower but within normal range. And the bottom line is that athletes generally eat extra vitamins. So the more you exercise, the hungrier you get, the more you eat. And that's assuming that you are eating. So the more you exercise, the more food you eat, the more vitamins you get. But some athletes don't eat more. Some athletes are very weight conscious. Maybe they have an eating disorder. They're dealing with anorexia. Maybe they are having to lose weight to be a lightweight rower. The nutrients of particular concern are iron, calcium, and vitamin D. And so there's different conversations for different people. And so that there can be a time and a place for vitamin supplements. But for the average healthy, hearty athlete with a robust intake, you know, keep in mind that one stalk of broccoli that's cooked gives you all the vitamin C that you need for a day. You know, most athletes eat a pile of broccoli and get 3 or 4 times more vitamin C that they need through food. We really need to appreciate the power of fruits and vegetables. You know, tart cherry juice, as studies show that it reduces the pain and inflammation in women with arthritis. It improves sleep. You know, this can be really helpful for traveling athletes. Palm Wonderful pomegranate juice. It has these polyphenols that reduce delayed onset muscle soreness. You know, they had a study where people consumed a bottle of Palm Wonderful a day, 8 ounces, a serving a day, for 8 days before they did damaging exercise, and it helped to reduce delayed onset muscle soreness. Beets, spinach, nitrate-rich foods improve oxygen utilization, reduces blood pressure. If you have a nitrate-rich food 2.5 hours before the event, you know, it can improve performance. In this study, cyclists improved their 4-kilometer and 16-kilometer time trial by almost 3%. Like, you know, how much are Olympics won by? Fractions of a second. So that this is powerful. I'm really, highly encouraging of my athletes to focus in on nitrate-rich foods because we know that they improve health. The DASH diet helps to lower blood pressure, and that's the nitrates, but also enhances performance. So nitrate-rich foods, arugula, bok choy, rhubarb, lettuce, beets, spinach, zucchini, green beans. But something like arugula, you know, if you, you know, or spinach, I mean, if you buy a bag of it, you know, you cook it down, it cooks down to nothing. And you can just eat a whole bunch of it that way for not many calories. But we know that 400 milligrams of nitrates in a lunchtime salad reduce blood pressure by 3 to 5 milligrams of mercury in 2.5 hours. For athletes, 300, 600 milligrams of nitrates a day for 2 to 6 days offers performance benefits during high intensity exercise that lasts for more than 5 to 30 minutes. But for health reasons, if nothing else, you know, chow down on, you know, arugula, romaine, iceberg lettuce salads, spinach salads, all your greens, and it will do no harm. Vitamin D, also called the sunshine vitamin, is a vitamin of interest these days. Among athletes, there are a lot of athletes that spend a lot of time indoors, and they are at risk for low vitamin D. Basketball players, figure skaters, gymnasts, ballerinas, wrestlers, you know, do they ever see daylight? Even people that live in the South, in Louisiana, low serum vitamin D was in 40% of the distance runners. Now, how could that be? You know, they're in the southern states. Well, when do they train? You know, before the sun gets up or at nighttime or indoors in the gym because it's too hot and humid. So even if you live in warmer climate, you know, sometimes the heat just drives you indoors. Vitamin D has potential benefits to athletes. And perhaps will reduce the risk of stress fractures, inflammation, infectious illness, impaired muscle function. And so this is something that I look for with athletes. It's in milk, but if athletes aren't drinking milk, dairy milk, then they might not be getting that. You know, sometimes athletes, what about like vitamin C and E? Aren't these antioxidants that are really important? Well, too many antioxidants can become pro-oxidants and can hinder training adaptations. So there's been studies done with vitamin C and vitamin E taken as supplements that might have negative effects. But if you take these, get these naturally through food, such as fruits, vegetables, it's very unlikely to cause only harm and more likely to be very, very beneficial. So that's another reason why I recommend food over supplements, in that we get it in its natural form in a natural matrix, and nature seems to know best. Now, when I'm counseling my athletes and helping them plan their sports diet, I see eating as a timeline, and I get a food bucket every 4 hours. For example, on my schedule, breakfast at 7, lunch at 11, second lunch at 3, and that might be divided into fueling up, refueling if I'm exercising in the afternoon, dinner at 6 or 7. If I exercise in the morning, my breakfast bucket, you know, fuel up, refuel part of it before breakfast, part of it afterwards. But in each food bucket, you know, I give my clients a calorie target, you know, more or less, you know, 600 calories 4 times a day for a woman, 2,400 calories for an active woman would not be out of question. And in each of their buckets, I want them to have some grain to fuel their muscles, some protein to build and repair their muscles, some fruits and vegetables for vitamins and minerals, and some calcium-rich food, such as dairy or non-dairy alternatives, for their bones and for helping to manage blood pressure. So if grains should be the foundation of each meal, they want something, wheat, rice, corn, oats, and The dietary guidelines say that whole grain should be at least half the choices, but it doesn't have to be all the choices because refined grains actually are enriched with iron and B vitamins. And so if you have only whole grains, you might be missing out on an important source of iron and B vitamins. And this is particularly important for people that don't eat red meat. So their breakfast cereal, it could be good if they had an enriched breakfast cereal. So look at oatmeal, you know, old-fashioned, all-natural oatmeal, only 8% the daily value of iron, whereas a packet of the instant oatmeal has 40% of the daily value for iron. You know, cereals, all-natural puffins, only 4% of the iron, whereas Cheerios has 45%. All-natural kashi, only 10%. You know, Trader Joe's has some good bran flakes that are enriched, 45%. You know, the different brown rice is only 4% iron, white rice is 8%. So again, this is just to keep in context that you don't have to have, you know, whole grains at every meal. But if you have, you know, oatmeal for breakfast and whole wheat bread for lunch, if you have white rice for dinner, like it's okay. You don't have to have a perfect diet to have an excellent diet. In terms of fruits and vegetables, you know, I sort of glump both fruits and vegetables together and look at colors and have my clients identify all the different colors that they eat. Do they have oranges, blueberries, green kiwi, white bananas? White is a color. You know, orange peaches, red watermelon. And make sure that in each of their food buckets, they have some sort of color. And when they eat them, just eat, if they don't like fruits, then just eat piles of vegetables. Or if they don't like vegetables, they have lots of fruit smoothies so that they can sort of be interchanged. In terms of calcium-rich foods, you know, we're looking at milk, yogurt, cheese, cottage cheese. But if people are not doing dairy, then they still need the calcium and they could get it from calcium-rich orange juice. Most almond milk, rice milks, whatever, are enriched with calcium. They might not have the vitamin D, however. You can get some calcium from leafy vegetables. You just need to eat a lot of them, which some people do. And there are always sardines with bones, and I've only met like one person that really truly enjoys her sardines with bones. There's a lot of confusion about plant-based milks, and commonly my clients say, oh, almond milk is better than dairy milk, isn't it? And they talk about how, oh, I switched to almond milk because it has fewer calories. Oh, I've stopped doing dairy. Almond milk is healthier. Oh, I have trouble digesting dairy, so I use almond milk instead. And is this okay? Almond milk is not a nutritional swap for dairy milk. If we compare plant beverages to dairy milk, if you compare dairy milk, almond breeze, oat milk, pea milk, soy milk, you know, there's calcium. They, you know, you can add calcium to any of them. But if you are having a plant-based milk, know that the calcium settles to the bottom. So if you're having almond milk, shake it up before you drink it so you get more of an even distribution of the calcium. In terms of protein, almond milk, 1 gram of protein versus dairy, 8. You know, pea milk, soy milk are the alternatives to dairy milk. Price-wise, you know, if you're having pea milk, 88 cents a glass versus 32 cents a glass. So we really have to look at the conversation and figure out why the person is having plant-based milk. And if they're lactose intolerant, then certainly soy or Ripple is an option, but so is lactate milk or taking a lactate pill. But almond milk is really almond juice, and people need to think of it that way. It is not a milk alternative. In terms of plant protein-rich foods, I look to make sure that there's some protein in each food bucket. And if it's plant protein or animal protein, just as long as there's protein, that's okay with me. And if they're making sure they're getting enough of it, if they are not eating red meat, which is one of the best sources of iron, I We look at for alternate sources of iron, be it in enriched breakfast cereals, cooking in a cast iron skillet. those would be good sources. So the bottom line is that we need to respect the power of food on performance and health. And I was talking to at Boston College to the hockey team there, and afterwards the coach, who was an excellent coach, said to me, "You know, Nancy, too many athletes show up for training, but they don't show up for meals. They might as well not show up for training." And that coach had it right on the nail, hit the nail on the head. And so many coaches and athletes think that performance starts with training. Actually, performance starts with fueling. And that's where registered dietitians, sports dietitians can have a really big impact on how well an athlete can perform. And then there's Mickey Mantle, who said, "You know, if I'd known I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself." And I remember one day when I was working for a team and this skinny athlete came up to me eating this great big Danish pastry and said, "You know, Nancy, I can eat this because I'm skinny." And it's like, oh, you're missing the boat. You're missing the boat. You want to take better care of yourself. And the bottom line is everyone always wins with good nutrition. So I hope that this session has been helpful for you. And if you're looking for more information, my sports nutrition guidebook has sections on day-to-day, how do you manage the American food supply, sections on sports nutrition, fueling up, fueling during, refueling, sections on weight, how to lose weight and have energy to exercise, how to deal with dieting gone awry, then a whole bunch of quick and easy recipes that can help you build a better sports diet. You're also welcome to email me. You can contact me through my website, nancyclarkrd.com. And I just hope that I leave you with this message that food is powerful. It can be powerfully bad for you. It can be powerfully good for you. And we really want to help our athletes to win with powerfully good nutrition.